Lots more to talk about with space historian Robert Zimmerman when we come back, and we'll add you to the mix. Phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Robert Zimmerman with us. We'll get to your phone calls as well. What's new on Behind the Black, Robert?
Oh, I cover the news of space continuously all the time. I've got a science fiction book out, Pioneer, which is kind of cool because it really did predict what's happening right now, First Contact story. And, just keep posting every day things that I think are important. One of the things I've been doing is I've been digging into the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter archives and posting on like a weekly basis very obscure but spectacular images of places on Mars that they've been photographing and trying to give some context and understanding of what we're looking at, because this is a place people want to eventually go. And I've been doing that pretty regularly. And, I cover things like the SpaceX decision, Elon Musk's announcement earlier this week that a Japanese fashion designer has purchased the first lunar mission of the Big Falcon.
He's a billionaire, and he's going into space.
It's very interesting. When he walked out to make his first line, he doesn't speak great English, but he chose to say, echoing John Kennedy back in 61, "I choose to go to the moon." and that's interesting because he's saying that he as an individual has chosen that. And he paid for the flight. They didn't say how much he paid, but it was enough to buy all the seats. And he's going to put...
He's bringing his friends,
six
right?
to eight artists to go with him. He's an art collector, and to bring their art with them. He's a billionaire. He has the money to do this, and he wants to do it. And I think it's just wonderful.
Let's take some calls for you. Let's go to first-time caller Jerry in Kansas City, Kansas, to get things started. Hi, Jerry.
Hi there, George.
Good to have you with us.
I was talking to the lady and telling her about my experiences at O'Hare Field. I was there and welcomed Neil Armstrong and Buzz when they came back from the moon.
Oh,
I
how
opened
great.
The door.
Exciting.
Congratulations. I'm honored. You had a lucky
so
month.
So much fun. The boys were so excited before we went there, about a year before. I worked at O'Hare, and they built a special room. Braniff Airlines was the company I worked for, and they were based in Dallas and Houston, and they used to fly the astronauts back and forth and all the people from Mission Control.
Yes, a lot of the private companies like Braniff would offer free flights for the publicity and also for the goodwill to help these guys along. One of the things that there was a guy in I think Florida who always would offer a place for the astronauts to go to have their summer vacations on the beach. And it was, he had a hotel, but he would offer it to them, and it would give them some privacy, and they'd be able to take their kids. And that's to honor them for what they were doing, where they won't, the hotel might get some benefit from it, just as Braniff does from the publicity. But the truth of the matter is, what's really going on is you're honoring someone willing to do a great thing.
I was with Buzz Aldrin on a Larry King TV show years ago, and great guy. As long as you don't tell him to put his hand on a Bible, he's
well,
a great guy.
It's interesting, when he was on the lunar surface, he also prayed. He took communion,
mm-hmm.
and he prayed. Now, people change. Just all three astronauts, not all three, I shouldn't take that back, the Apollo 8 astronauts, some of them changed. Bill Anders was a very serious practicing Catholic.
They did a Masonic
say again?
Drink on the moon. And I went through the whole Masonic ritual when they got up there. They were all Masons.
The thing is that as time passes, they chose different routes. And like Bill Andrews decided he could not, as he told me, he could not any longer accept the specific rituals of Catholicism. Because how, after seeing the moon and the earth from such a place, how could any specific religion know the specific things that God might want? He didn't become a non-believer. He just simply couldn't accept any particular religion anymore. And Valerie said, it was really shocking, his change. But, that's all right. But people change, and that's perfectly okay.
I knew Edgar Mitchell from Apollo 14, and he became very metaphysical.
Yes,
I mean,
he did.
Extremely.
He tried, when he went on that mission, he tried to do ESP experiments.
Mind control and stuff like that.
They did not work, but he was attempting to do real science to show whether or not that's possible, and he basically got the equivalent of random results on the ground comparing what he was seeing on the spaceship. But still, that's a good science. He's trying to do something that really meant a lot to him. Yeah, the astronauts, it's interesting, the response of the astronauts after the fact. I mean, Jim Lovell, he didn't change at all. He says, look, God is, you can find God anywhere. Well, you know, it's not going to change, doesn't change my opinion of the universe and its formation just because I went to the moon. He's very matter of fact about it. Things, it didn't change anything with him.
Let's go back to Jerry for a minute. Jerry,
they're all like little boys, and they, boy, we're going to do it. We're really going to do it. And they didn't think that they could, but finally they did. And when they came back, they bounced out of that plane, and then we put this big parade on for them, and everybody in Chicago, the streets were just lined up on both sides as thick as they could get, and it was marvelous. I really enjoyed that memory.
That's exciting. Thanks, Jerry, for sharing that. Robert, what do you think of the movie First Man depicting Neil Armstrong, and they stupidly forgot to put the planting of the flag on them?
Because I have not actually seen the film yet, I posted on Behind the Black this story right away, and my first reaction is this is typical Hollywood hatred of the United States. They wanted to emphasize this American achievement. This was not a worldwide achievement. We did it. And, you know, the statement on the LEM capsule, we came in peace for all mankind. We, the United States, Americans, came in peace for everyone in the world, but we did it. Now, I haven't seen the movie. I've gotten very mixed information about what's going on. I have gotten some direct information that, yes, they didn't leave the American flag out of the movie. They didn't leave the flag out on the moon, it appears, but they didn't include the scene where they planted the flag.
And
I can maybe understand that if the focus is going to be about Neil Armstrong as a human being. But I do have direct information, at least information from someone who talked to the producer, the company that made the film itself, and they admit that in certain situations they de-emphasized or hid the American flag on uniforms. And this is because they want to have good distribution in places like China. And I say hogwash. No one in China is not going to watch this film if the American flag isn't there. The only reason they're probably being forced to take it out or de-emphasize is because a lot of their money is coming from the Chinese investors who are influenced by the Chinese government and is telling them what to do and does not want the American flag shown.
That's a possibility.
Oh, that's no question that. Hollywood is significantly influenced by Chinese money these days and the Chinese market. And China is not a free capitalist country. As much as they have some private companies, like in the space program, they say they have private companies. That's hogwash. Every one of those companies are tightly controlled by the government. And in the case like this, if they're financing any of this film, the government is going to tell the financiers that we want certain things to happen. And the cowards that made this film agreed to do that. Now, once again, I haven't seen the film, so I might have a completely different impression when I see it. So I'm a little bit hesitant to blast it hard at this moment, but I have not been encouraged by this kind of thing. The politics of Hollywood is sometimes quite disgusting and anti-American these days. The academic community and Hollywood is anti-American, and that's disgusting in a case like this. I mean, this was done, once again, as I saw with Apollo 8. These astronauts wanted to express goodwill to everyone. We came in peace for all mankind. This was an attempt to do something wonderful and great for everyone, but it was done by America.
Let's go to Carlos on the island of Oahu in Hawaii. Hi, Carlos.
Aloha, George.
You too, my friend. Thank
Aloha,
you.
Cousin Stuart. George, I've been to the moon, and as far as disclosure, we already have bases on the moon. The bases we have on the moon are on the bright side, not around on the dark side, and we also have a way station on Mars. But that's not what I...
Well, I got to ask you, how did you get to the moon?
The first time, it was the Jupiter Project Skylab mission, which was a secret mission in 1973, and I'm sure that Mr. Zimmerman knows about it, the Jupiter Project.
Sorry, Carlos, we're going to have to agree to disagree. Having spoken to hundreds of astronauts and engineers at NASA. I haven't the faintest idea what you're talking about. And so, and believe me, I've talked to a lot of people who have clearances. I haven't. So go ahead.
Let's finish him up and get your reaction.
Alan Shepard, I know that.
Go ahead, Carlos.
But that's not the point. The point, what I called about was we found microbes on the moon, which are called granulomas. And for whatever reason, no one will discuss the microbes that we found on the moon that are called granulomas.
I'll
there are people who have done research projects and have been studying the granulomas, but I think it's time to disclose the existence of granulomas, and that granulomas, in fact, are a life form that we found on the lunar.
All right, Robert, what's he talking about?
I have no idea specifically of that particular substance, but I can tell you that, yes, they found a piece of bacteria on the moon, and it was attached to the Surveyor craft that soft landed on the moon prior to the Apollo 12 mission, actually prior to any of the Apollo missions. That was one of the early unmanned soft landers to try to learn something about the surface in prep for the missions. And the Apollo 12 mission, captained, commanded by Alan Shepard, landed within 600 feet of that, and they walked over and they grabbed some parts off it to bring back to Earth. And what they found on those parts is some bacteria. And was it from the moon? That's a good question.
Or was it contamination? Was it contamination?
That's the question. The conclusion the scientists have, and it is science, so we can be uncertain about this. The conclusion they had was that it was a contamination from Earth. There have been no microbes found in any of the, as far as I know, and I could not have, there could be some research I'm not familiar with, but as far as I know, no microbes have been found in any of the moon rocks themselves, unless it could possibly be, is considered contamination.
True.
And that's about the only area that I'm aware of any kind.
Martian rocks, that's different. The meteorite.
Martian rocks are a very interesting situation. Yeah, I mean, there's real uncertainty there. There are scientists who unequivocally believe that they have seen microbes. There are others that unequivocally believe, nope, those were not microbes. They got it wrong. We don't know. There's enough data about Mars, both from the Viking right through to today, that suggests the possibility of microbial life under the surface. Have we found it? Have we seen it? It's probably to say no, but I will say also that's uncertain, without question.
Let's go to Joe in Long Island, New York. Joseph, take it away.
Yeah, hi, Bob. Two questions. Kennedy's speech was really inspirational, and, you know, from what I understand from people from that era, they say he was just an incredible speaker. But within NASA, how much did that speech resonate? Was it taken as almost like a mandate? Or is it just coincidental that they did make it up there before the end of the decade? My second question would be about the astronauts themselves. You know, their prior flight, like, for example, Frank Borman supposedly had about 6,000 hours in the air before he went to the moon, including, I believe, flying fighter jets, which is a pretty risky proposition, and those supersonic jets. Now, I'm wondering, you know, for your book, are these people ultra confident? Are they? I don't think most people walking around would have that type of personal confidence.
All three of the men were jet pilots and test pilots. And so, therefore, they were willing to risk their lives routinely in a plane.
And good ones.
And spacecraft. Yeah. So you have to be very confident, and you have to put aside fear. That doesn't mean you're not afraid, but you put it aside to do what you need to do. And this is answering your second question. I'm not going to forget the first question. It is a remarkable thing, even to this day, how few mistakes are made by astronauts. In space, they focus on getting the job done right, and they know they're responsible to do that. And the Apollo, the 60 space flights, especially through Skylab into the early shuttle flights, it's really remarkable how few errors, in fact, they practically no errors were made. The astronauts saved the day of technology failing many times. And that's so it is an interesting thing. Two things. The first time I met Jim Lovell, he was the first astronaut of the three that I interviewed. And I was saying, my God, this is the first astronaut I'm ever interviewing face to face. And oh my God, he's awful short. He's small. He's much smaller than I thought. And that's they all tend to be small.
Well, they're like jockeys, not quite that small, but they're little.
Yeah. They tend to be smaller, but they're not always. The second thing is, though, Bill Anders, he met me at a train station. We were going to drive 2 hours to his house. We got into a sports car. He backed out of the parking spot at about 45, 50 miles an hour. Left the parking lot at about 80 miles an hour. He likes to go fast.
Oh.
That was one of the reasons he did the mission. He was able to set the world speed record for a human being returning back to Earth. He likes to go fast. Yes, they're courageous men. Now, the second question that Joe had about Kennedy's speech. Kennedy's speech was not about the space program. Kennedy's speech was about beating the Soviet Union in the Cold War, proving that capitalism and freedom is the right way to go. And he wanted to demonstrate that. And he talked about a lot of other things. Most of the speech was about other things that they could do to prove to the world, to the third world, the world that wasn't allied with either country, that freedom and capitalism is the right way to go. And he topped it off with the lunar landing. That lunar landing idea came out of NASA, and people at NASA who proposed it to him, and he latched onto it and said, yep, this fits the politics of the moment. I'm going to do it. Later, after he was assassinated, there is no doubt at all, culturally within NASA and within the entire United States, that they wanted to meet his commitment by the end of the decade because he had been assassinated. This was to commit to complete to fulfill a promise to a man that had died. And there's no question that was one of the components that pushed NASA forward and the whole nation, because you got to remember there were 100,000 somewhat companies involved and private citizens, maybe in the millions involved in making parts and sections and everything about this. And they're all very aware of that commitment to finish by the end of the decade, and everyone wanted to do it. And me as a 16-year-old, you know, teenager throughout that decade, I was very aware. You could just sense it within the culture. We have to do this for him more than anything else.
And don't forget how we panicked in 1957 when the Soviets sent Sputnik up there.
Yes, and that was that was one of the reasons why Kennedy made this speech. As part of the Cold War, we were very afraid of Khrushchev and the Soviets. Remember, Khrushchev had said, "We will bury you." They were very aggressive, and we were really afraid that our freedom was threatened. And he wanted to demonstrate on all fronts that we could beat them. And that's why he made that speech. If you actually read the speech, you will be amazed how little it talks about space. It's not about space. It's about the Cold War.
Let's go to Mark in Modesto, California, see if we have some time for you. Mark, get your quick question in. Go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. Thanks for Coast to Coast, as always.
Sure thing.
Yeah, you know, you bring up a lot of interesting points, but isn't the real payload on the moon helium-3? And you know, we've seen all the robotic missions in the past decades to other planets way further than the moon.
Helium-3 is very important, Robert, 30 seconds before the break, but that's a mission, right?
This is a potential profit. There's no question of that, and a lot of companies want to mine it for many reasons. We don't really know what's going to be profitable on the moon. You know, in the colonies, it was tobacco. No one predicted that. And so in American colonies, and so it could be helium-3, and people are going to go to do it. There's no question of that. That's money to be made. Might be water, though, in the end, for other colonies and other space operations.
What about diamonds?
Nah. No, they haven't found any evidence of that. It's not likely on the moon. But then again, you know, there's a lot of dust and soot on these asteroids and on the moon, and who knows? Yeah, maybe.
All right, we're going to come back and take final phone calls with Robert Zimmerman. Then later on, we talk about In Search of Lost Lives with Michael Goddard on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, talking about the Japanese craft approaching the asteroid, sending a couple rovers there, which will hit, I think, sometime tomorrow. What do you think asteroids came from? An exploded planet?
No, I mean, they are mostly left over from the formation of the solar system itself. As the sun coalesced into a star, It was a nebula, it was a gas cloud with lots of other material that was coalescing. It didn't all get thrown into the sun. It got thrown into rings, a disk of material around the sun that slowly coalesced into more objects, and eventually the bigger objects started to absorb the smaller ones. But, you know, they don't get everything, and so you've got some leftovers. Some of them are left over from far out, and they migrate in, and some get thrown out again. We'll learn a lot in January when New Horizons on January 1st flies past Ultima Thule.
Yes.
That's what they nicknamed this Kuiper Belt object. We've never seen a Kuiper Belt object in any way close up, and this is going to give us a close view, and it's going to be very alien and very different. So, you know, some of them are thought to have come from planets that have broken up, because some of the initial planets, you know, hit each other. They get broken up again. So they get like Vesta, that Dawn visited in this asteroid belt. It very clearly was once part of a larger object and got hit at one point and cracked and broken to pieces. Making the solar system is not a clean and easy job. It doesn't happen in 7 days, despite the genesis, and that's okay.
Isn't technology amazing?
It always is.
The fact to be able to do these things.
You have to just think, if you were born in 1880, there was no electricity, pretty much no electricity, no cars, no phones, no television, no washing machines, no, in many cases, no indoor plumbing. You go back, you go 100 years, you've got all those things, and we're just barely beginning to have the first space station, first space missions in space. And now we've gotten to a point in the 21st century where we're controlling rovers 100 plus miles away, 100 million
millions
miles
away
on the ground. And that, you know, we've got rovers driving all over Mars. You're going to have another one land. You can have, Lander this year. You can have at least two.
A couple more coming. Yeah.
You know, we have two on Mars right now. Both are
still functioning. One got stuck in a dust storm, but I think it'll be okay.
Well, we don't know. Opportunity sitting there has not been, we've not heard from it. They're optimistic it might come back to life, but we should be warned it might not. And Curiosity right now actually had a sudden problem where they cannot download data. The spacecraft, they have two different data streams. One is real-time data that tells them the status of the spacecraft, and the other is the download, you know, stuff off the hard drive. And they have the real-time contact. The spacecraft is in fine shape, but for some reason it's not downloading its data. And they're trying to figure out what this is. So suddenly we have a stall on Curiosity, and we'll have to hope and wait and see what happens. But more rovers coming, and, you know, it's still pretty remarkable. And, you know, that a spacecraft just flew past Pluto and is going to be going past a Kuiper Belt object, and we'll control it from literally billions and billions of miles. Is truly amazing. There's no doubt about that.
Let's go to Buck in Limestone, West Virginia. And before we get his question, Buck, how are you feeling, sir?
George, I really want to thank you and Tom and the Coast Faithful for everything. I've got a whole new outlook. I mean, things are certainly better than they were.
Good.
I've got something to shoot for now. I got a little bit more time than I thought, so I really credit Coast and all you people with helping me out there.
Well, good for you. We want you around as long as you can hang in there, kid.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. George, I just wanted to thank Mr. Zimmerman for reminding us how important that mission, Apollo 8 mission, was when they circled the moon. I remember it very well. And you mentioned indoor plumbing 100 years ago. I think that's the time that the Apollo 8 mission was up is about the time we got indoor plumbing here. But at any rate, I want to thank them, because it really brought back a lot of memories, and it made me think how important that mission was, even 50 years later. I mean, back then, for those of us that are old enough, remember in 1968, things were pretty much in turmoil, George, remember?
That's right. Absolutely.
You know, Vietnam, and Martin Luther King, Bobby, and Chicago, and everything. But you know what? That's really the comment that Mr. Zimmerman made, that those guys did more, and I wrote it down, those guys did more than that which cannot be measured. You know, one thing it did do, I remember it took me back to that time, it gave us hope. That mission gave us hope. And
sure did.
Things were pretty messed up. And I think about now, you know, that there is hope, you know, that the message from the astronauts back then resonates today. You know, that things seem all messed up, and they are, but I think we have hope. We have hope that things will get better.
Absolutely. And you keep getting better, Buck, all right?
Okay, thanks a lot, George, and thanks, Mr. Zimmerman, for your guest.
You know, Brock, I must say that everything that this mission, Apollo 8, tried to accomplish still applies. It tells us that human beings can always be greater than we are,
yep.
And the limits of our abilities are, we always underestimate them. And if we're willing to go with our dreams as hard as we can, we will accomplish things we cannot imagine.
Buck has been fighting for his life, Robert. About a month ago, we thought he was going to lose that battle, and he's seems like he's getting stronger.
Thank God.
Yep, absolutely.
Thank God.
Chris in Birmingham, Alabama is with us now. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hey there.
First of all, thank you so much, Mrs. Zimmerman and Nori and Buck. I'm so glad you're doing well.
That's fantastic. Thank you, Chris.
That is fantastic. I was just going to just have a comment, not an argument by any means. No argument. I have not seen the film either yet, The First Man. So, because it's not out yet.
Yeah, it comes out in October.
Right. Yeah. And I would love to have the same conversation again after the fact, but, the family has already come out and said that it's more about a global, you know, accomplishment. Of course, that's what it was initially. I know that's what it was. The thing is, I'm wondering so much about, you know, the American flag is in the film a lot, apparently.
Yeah.
The thing is, you know, it's hard. It's hard for me to see it either because same as you. Like, I haven't seen it either.
We've got to see it. We've got to watch the film and see what it's like.
We got to wait and watch.
Yeah.
It seems like it's more like a biopic, you know, kind of like a personal.
Yes, Chris. There's no question that the focus here was to tell Neil Armstrong's personal
story,
which is a good thing. Yeah. It's based on his biography, and I think there's nothing wrong with that, absolutely not.
But they should have put the planting of the flag and the salute, and there was nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Once again, I understand. I was in the movie business, George. Remember,
I know that.
I've written screenplays based on events. You have to make editorial choices, and I can accept that if it's in the right context of telling Armstrong's story, and it doesn't diminish the importance of the American achievement. And we don't know what they have done, but I'm worried because I've gotten indications that they did make choices that would diminish the
importance. Yes, exactly. Plus,
Chris, go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, plus Robert. People are so upset over the kneeling episodes at football games, and so people are uptight about the flag.
Yes, I mean the country feels that a lot of people do not understand how wonderful America is. And look, I will be honest. I have great contempt. Utter contempt for the football players that are kneeling because they're millionaires being paid to play football, and they're in America, and that's what made it possible for them to do that, the American way of life. And for them to kneel in disrespect to the Star Spangled Banner, which is celebrating the way of life they live in, and the flag, appalls me. And so I have utter contempt. And,
See, the
expressions of hatred for the United States from Hollywood repeatedly, people are upset about this. So the first initial reaction when we heard this from the Canadian actor playing Armstrong, that is a global mission, people got very upset. I got very upset. I'm willing to give them a benefit of the doubt. I have to wait and see the movie, but I'm very, very, very suspicious. I just have seen this
mm-hmm.
happen too many times.
I think you're right. Harry in Port Huron, Michigan's with us. Harry, go ahead.
Well, thank you, George. My question for you, well, two of them. One, Rob, is how much money does the government per year spend on the space program. And my second one would be, I like where you're going as far as the private sector should be running the space program. If that's the case, and I agree, I think it should be, what about defunding the space program from a federal perspective, not putting tax dollars into it completely?
All right, well, Harry, very good questions. One, NASA's budget these days is around $25, $26 billion per year. You could spend probably $6 or $7 billion less and get more done if they had their priorities more straight and they let private sector do things more. I've written about that on Behind the Black at length. There is a paper I wrote, a policy paper called Capitals in Space. You can download it off Behind the Black for free. It's a PDF, and it outlines in great detail the problems of the private sector versus government space effort. What I do know, I would like to see NASA significantly defunded. I've never been a big fan of the big government program. In fact, you used the phrase you said, Harry, about having private enterprise run the space program sends makes me cringe, because I don't want a space program. The very phrase is Soviet in style. A program means it's dictated, it's run, it's organized, there's someone on top telling everyone what to do. What I want is freedom. It means Elon Musk does his thing, makes money. Jeff Bezos does his thing. Rocket Lab, which is based in the U.S., but they fly out of New Zealand. It's a small sat rocket company. They do their thing. Mm-hmm. I want everyone to be doing their thing. NanoRacks is trying to make money off of satellites on ISS. They do their thing. You've got Bigelow trying to put space stations up. That's their thing. There's no program there. That's each person following their own thing. Now, whether you can defund NASA, one of the problems you've got is pork. And you've got a Congress, doesn't matter which party it is, that is irresponsible about spending. They are bankrupting us by their spending. And I'm not one of those guys who says, you got to cut the government, but don't touch NASA. I say absolutely touch NASA. Everybody has to pay. And I think NASA's budget could be – we need space. That's one of the reasons I mentioned capital space. I outline why, as a nation, the we need a space effort. We need for the military. We need missiles. We need that technology. For the prestige of participating, we need to participate. But there are better ways to do it than how we're doing it now. And the private enterprise is showing the route that we should go. And it's not – a new discovery. It's what built the nation. We just kind of forgot it for the last 50 years.
What if we get a space program like a James Bond movie and one of these private enterprises launches some kind of super weapon and blackmails the world?
I'm not worried. You got to remember, a private company, think about the mentality. Someone who wants to dominate the world like that is into power. And private companies, they're not into power. They're into making a profit. If they do something like that, their customers go away.
They're gone.
They don't make any money. They want to do is build products that people want to buy. And that's not building a super weapon to take over the world. That's the kind of thing you'd expect from a top-down government program. Because people in government are there not to make money, but to make power. Gain power. And of course, they get a nice living out of it while they oppress everybody else, but they're in power. But private companies, that's not their goal. Their goal is to make a living and to make a profit so they can do more of the same thing. And when you're trying to make a profit, you're trying to provide a service that people will voluntarily buy. And the very nature of capitalism is freedom and a voluntary choice of everyone to work together to get what they want. And so I'm not worried about private companies in this respect in the slightest, not in the slightest.
Let's go to Don in Shreveport, Louisiana, first-time caller. Donald, go for it.
Hello, how are y'all?
Hi.
One quick question, and I'm going to share someone I met that worked in the space program, his story about the monkey. But do you know why the last run of the ladder, the distance, you know, with the one giant leap, but they also had to leap back in. I'm assuming they thought the moon was soft, but they never changed it. Do you know why that run didn't go all the way down?
Donald, I can make an educated guess. I have to do some research. I might have once known. I have a feeling I once did. I'll make an educated guess. It had to do with the legs of the LEM and weight. they had to trim every ounce to get that LEM down to size. One of the reasons the LEM was not ready for Apollo 8 was they couldn't get the size down. So everything they could cut out to save weight, they did. Everything. And so I'll be very honest. The astronauts, the lunar gravity is light. They figured out how far the astronauts could jump and whether they could. And, hey, we can take a rung out and save some weight. My first guess would be that.
And with minimal gravity, they figured they could jump back up.
That's exactly right. And that's my first. That would be my first guess, without question. I will tell you too that the rungs were purposely made so lightweight that if on Earth you tried to climb those rungs, they would bend. But on the Moon, the weight—you know—they couldn't take a full person's weight. But on the Moon, your weight is like 16%, and so there's not as much weight on the rungs. So they made them lighter in that respect to save weight. So that would be my first.
Good point. Don, we're out of time. We can't get the rest of your story. But, Mr. Zimmerman, how about giving out your website where people can get the updated Genesis book?
All right. Well, you can go to Behind the Black, behindtheblack.com. Think of the black sky the Luna astronauts had and that they looked at. That we're looking behind the black. And you can get all my books there, but Genesis, The Story of Apollo 8, both is available on Audible and all the audio available vendors. And the audio version, it's really a great reading by Grover Gardner. And so if you want to just be entertained for 9 hours in your car, it's really great. And the e-book is available on all vendors. You can get it from my website. I make a little more money if you do that. Pioneer, all my books are available through my website. People want to get a real thrill about what the future is really going to like. They could read Pioneer.
Super. Robert, thanks. Always great talking to you. Space historian, up next, In Search of Lost Lives.